Good evening from Belgrade and welcome. It is May 5, 2022. This is our second live stream of the day, actually. First one was much more clearly on the subject of how we look at time, paradigms, belief systems, the motivations of the ruling class. And it ties in very much both to the tragedy, which is Ukraine, it being run by proxy, by the Western cabal, had for some time the practices of this cabal. They have some kind of, it looks like, occult practice that involves a lot of esoteric things, exclusive, you know, that's the whole thing with esoterica. It's like it's a belief system on top of that's exclusive, on top of the exclusivity of the socioeconomic class that they are situated in. So it fits. It's one begets the other. Connection to Ukraine, of course, we're talking about Ukraine. Number one in human trafficking, number one in missing children and girls. Women traffic, organ trafficking, number one. These are all very bad signs. And for some time, colleagues of mine have said that Ukraine is a failed state. I know that, Patrick Henningsy said that as well. So there's that. Failed state is a difficult situation. This is like what was attempted to be done in Syria. I mean, it was halfway achieved. There is a Syria that remains. The situation is not solved there, but it's a lot of stability and normalcy has returned. For a lot of people, it's a slightly smaller country. They don't have access to all of their oil either. There is still some of this stuff around, but it's not a black hole of pulling in light and growing a chaos vector whirlwind across the region. That had been one of the plans for Ukraine, just to understand. One of the plans for Ukraine, we're talking about going back to 2014, was just to destabilize the whole thing. It was to destabilize the whole country and to draw in Russia and to create that quagmire situation. That sort of Afghanistan scenario, that's not either credible nor likely to occur. But a lot of people were sold on doing that. Thing doesn't have to be likely or even potentially that successful to build up a lot of traction around it. That's how these projects tend to work anyway. But the threat was real. See, the problem is that in talking about the reasons why Russia should not be feared vis-a-vis Ukraine, you have to remember that people making the rounds right now, like John Mersheimer, who, albeit very well considered and very considerate and thoughtful and intelligent man himself, I don't have no criticism of anything that he really would say, but I would say is his insistence that, I mean, it was sort of part of his equation, but his insistence that Russia would not get into Ukraine because it would be a quagmire is precisely the view that was echoed by a lot of people trying to create that crisis and trying to create that quagmire and trying to create that failed state. Yeah, there's a lot of the world's an ugly place. This is not about good guys and bad guys. There's sufficient cause to believe that Poroshenko was even a slightly stabilizing force. As crazy as that may seem to be, and you don't have to like the guy personally. He's apparently, even as a child, he was, a cry bully with other kids. And like the man that they give him their things or he cries, tells his mom, who would then like come beat kids up and stuff. That's the Poroshenko childhood. So you can know these things about a person's biography. These things are not that important. Parentage and these things don't figure in. Only as part of these kind of like Nazi genetic engineering projects that produced weird people, like maybe like Trudeau or Obama or something. They had these post-Nazi Dr. Mengele, this idea of creating like an evil supervillain leader or something like that. The CIA was really fixated on communists, but it was almost more of like a self-fulfilling belief system. But they got this American communist guy, maybe to father Obama, and they got, Castro to father Trudeau. I mean, that's the story, right? That's kind of interesting, but that's not the point. Those are almost like distractions, because the problems are like the policies. Why would you add this layer of, right? Like, what is that even? Is it? I guess it's interesting. So, what we had today across all of Ukraine was really quite a sight. Really quite a sight. And there are, we woke up this morning to news of a lot of artillery, a lot of shelling coming from the Russian side around the Kharkov area. And and it was also uncovered that Ukrainians are using these medical facilities throughout Ukraine for military purposes. They're using these medical facilities and human shields. So in Kharkov, there was an artillery and ammunition storage facility, and it was located at on a hospital in Slavyansk. This is from the Russian MOD, so for what it's worth, right, take it with a grain of salt. But in Slavyansk, the Russians are saying that heavy military equipment was placed where a railway hospital is, and an ammunition depot. And furthermore, they're claiming that in Odessa, that the Ukrainian army set up a command post in a regional clinical hospital, and that the armored vehicles were located like in the parking lot of the hospital. That's a lot like the mall that we saw in Kiev that got destroyed. So Russia actually thinks that these are problems, and they have actually raised them with the World Health Organization, because that's just like an organization that you could raise these with. They have no enforcement. Maybe they'll investigate, make a statement. It's like, oh, okay. Maybe some off chance the New York Times covers it, and then some asshole liberal thinks it's true finally. But whatever. So the World Health Organization has been ignoring it, Russians claim. I believe it. But today, so far, there was something as of 8 p.m. or 8:15 Moscow time. They're claiming that today about 200, between 190 and 200 Ukrainians were killed, soldiers, we should say. There was tons of video and reportage today that we went through. A lot of it where it's possible from, there's a translation, there's a Telegram channel that's translating anything related to like a war crime or a confession or something like that. And that's the John Sin Miedo, Juan, John the Fearless, or Juan Sin Miedo or something. It's just a name of a channel. It's not a person from what I can tell. Sort of a strange project. I believe it's, I might reach out to them and see what they're up to. But they've been producing a lot of the ones that you've seen with relating to war crimes and whatnot. And I'm always reluctant to share them because you don't know what they're being accused of, the particular soldiers. You just don't know what they're being accused of. And if their to what extent their statements are compelled. I mean, it's just, so you're in a war and you get captured. And now you're a POW. And maybe they're like giving you cigarettes and like three hots and a cot. And are you able to like make some phone calls and stuff? And you're like, things can only get worse. Like things aren't getting any better. And now they're asking me, you know, to say like whether I thought my commander had ordered that other guys in my unit kill people. Oh, I don't know. I've never been in that situation. I could have been. But I have a funny policy of not getting in to races where I don't have a dog. But those are the claims. It's not as many as yesterday, but it looks like today was a particularly low body count day. But I think on average, it's been about 300, 400. But if you calculate the Russian claims of 50,000 altogether, but you have to look at that's, you know, total number. It includes a lot. Injured. But if you just parse out the killed in action and you start to multiply out or divide rather by the number of days in the conflict, you get a pretty decent number. That it's pretty consistently hundreds. About 400, 300, something like this. That's what you see.
Some of the footage that I avoid, there's been a practice of colorizing color photos. I don't like to share those. They look weird. Everything looks like Legos or looks weird. Looks like there's a lot of effort put into some of these photos, or they like do some program that like turns up this kind of weird reddish brown in things. I saw it with the Mariupol photography. I saw it with some photographs of Wagner. Anyway, you know, I don't think that this is informative material. I don't do the cheerleading much. I'm not Russian. I'm also not a teenager. So I'm not into or impressed with the aesthetics of war. It's more to me, I see just too much potential tragedy and damage. I'm not soft about it or anything. I don't stay up at night crying over the humanity of it all. But but I also just don't share the things that I don't think. I mean, I really spend a lot of time curating the channel. A lot of time. I go through a lot of material just because I want the channel. I have a certain idea in mind of who is using the channel. And there's different types, of course, but certainly there has to be a lot of material. But there are people who kind of doom scroll all day, or they are information, you know. I did news for a long time. I'd done television news. I was a regular on a couple of country, different Russia, Iran, different countries, India, Pakistan. I've done a lot of news. And I also ran a little newspaper. So I have an idea about sort of like news audiences. And what I find is that there are people who really are following the story closely, and they really want up to the minute stuff. And they drive most of the traffic. And also, they go to a lot of different channels. And they try to find all kinds of stuff for interest. They're just looking for, there's sort of this thing called FOMO. It's called fear of missing out. That also keeps people up late at night. So I know this is kind of like fourth wall stuff, but when you're curating a channel, and I explicitly say this isn't news. Well, they terminated my PayPal anyway. But that's the least of my concerns. It had been frozen for 18 months. Yeah, there's like sizable amount of money that's been frozen there for over a year and a half. I can't get it out. But in the middle of this process where they were having me answer tons of information requests, then this final word came down, I guess, like Zelensky demanded it. I don't know. I think it's a funny idea. Now, previously, I had opened up the questions. And I have sufficient stuff. So I'm going to get into it right now with you. Okay. Now, I was asked about South Africa, and while that's interesting to me personally, it's not why we're here. And I'm not going to do that much about South Africa. If you're particularly philanthropic with the stuff, you know, through the normal way, and you message me, you know, directly through there, not through there, never message me through there, through Telegram, then never ever message me on Patreon. But when you message me through Telegram, sometimes it's available, or you can ask the moderators. I will answer a question. I just don't think it's really, you know, why we're here. It's not just what I want to get into talking about every world event. I could do a little research and give an answer, but I won't do it just because. Now, with the Azovstal buses, that was, I thought, super interesting. I think we will not know what happened. You can see how the information war ran. It's just exactly what we said it would be. We said there was going to be a lot of different events that would happen at the same time, and it wouldn't make sense. In fact, I called it exactly what would happen. I said exactly what would happen before it happened. Remember? I said they were going to have like different, it's not going to be clear which one is the UN or which one is the Russian. And when they come out, you're not going to really be able to tell what custody they went through or how they were checked. I bet there's all kinds of stuff going on. And I think there's this, what people want, I say this and this frustrates people, you know, and people want justice. And I'm not going to suggest that justice is too much to ask, but it's almost. What you want is to survive this fucking encounter, is what you're having, is an encounter, and you want to survive it. Justice, like what, comeuppance, or they get someone getting theirs? What you want is for the things that are happening not to happen again, and you want to create situations that limit them, and you want to disempower the people that make those happen. And sometimes those people end up offing each other, or they end up whatever. Life is really short, and focus on justice is not always, look, there should be, everyone who's driven towards it, be driven towards it. I'm not saying everything has a balance. I'm not encouraging or saying people shouldn't be pursuing justice. I'm just, it's not what I pursue. Justice is, in my view, a personal attribute. Justice is something that you have to get for yourself. Institutions don't deliver justice. There's no such thing as a justice system. Justice is a personality quality. So I'm not thinking that Zelensky is going to face justice or anything like this. I mean, just look at Saakashvili. Do people know who he is? The Georgian guy who ate his tie? He was like the head of Ukraine, he was the head of Georgia. And then there was the, he had this ridiculous office. He had a, you know, the Georgian flag, and he had a European Union flag, and he had a NATO flag. Georgia is neither. Anyway, so there he, but they wanted it to be like, yes, we're with you. So then Russia goes in and does its thing, right? Remember that? So 2008, something like this. So the dude is actually on TV. He didn't know the camera was running, and he's eating his tie. It looked like it was like a Marx Brothers or Charlie Chaplin or something. It was, I know I'm dating myself there, but it was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. He's eating his tie. Okay. So he failed. Then he like reappears in 2015 as a Ukrainian politician. It's like, these fuckers are totally transitory. They're just these little grabblers that, like whack-a-mole, like they pop up everywhere. They just reincarnate. So he re-emerges in Ukraine as like the mayor of some shit. I used to know the story. I put it into my short-term memory, not so important file in my cabinet, in my brain cabinet. I filed it over there. So I don't remember exactly. He was like mayor of something, governor of something, something in government, but you know, noticeable. And he was talking about running, like all of a sudden he had Ukrainian citizenship. I was like, what is this? Yeah, Saakashvili. It was hilarious. The guy is a comedian, though. He has these lovable, hateable attributes to him. Very bizarre. Maybe it's just my sentimentality with age. I just see everyone as children. I mean, I see the child in people. Makes people a lot more likable to me. Even people that are like rather despicable. Like, I look for the redeeming quality, you know. Forgive our trespasses as, you know, allow us that we may forgive our trespasses as we ourselves may be forgiven. And but these people, you know, these people just keep coming back. I mean, look at Yulia Tymoshenko. She was like, kill all the Russians, burn the fields, burn them all from here to Moscow, kill the women and children. It was vicious, it's disgusting. And she's still on the go. That life is short. People who are fixated on justice, I can't, you know, it's like, who am I? Nobody, right? But people who are fixated on that, they, you know, sometimes it's like you've got a 1 in 100 chance. You know, it's worth it. Go for the justice. We have a much better chance at the things that we're winning at. And we're winning, you know, we don't. These people have to face their own demons. These people have to live with themselves to understand how short life is. And how long eternity is. Yeah. See, we're not just these conscious beings occupying this domain. We're more than this. There's something more going on here. You realize that and start to see it. You don't sweat the justice thing. I mean, not with these larger than life things. It's not personal enough for you to seek justice. There are people that are personally affected, directly and personally harmed and affected, and they will go after the justice. And, you know, if they are passing the hat around, you know, chip in. Don't get me wrong. You know, chip in, you know, be a part of that effort to get justice, but don't count on it. Don't include that justice component in your victory conditions, or every victory will seem like a defeat. Turning the page. More and more news, just crazy news. I think that the like fake news, like MSM, I think that the legacy media, like Washington Post and New York Times, I think they have a lot of trust fund kids living in Brooklyn or Los Feliz. Silver Lake, Los Angeles area. Or Harlem. And they're like, you know, hipsters, assholes, whatever. And they get paid $1,000 or something. This is like the going rate. So, you know, some of these, like the Guardian used to pay like 1,500 pounds or something. Pay like $1,000 and you get this, you know, op-ed published. Others that are kind of like the staff, it's just like they get paid dog shit. I don't even, like, they go in debt to work there. It's everything is becoming like France, with the only people that have jobs, because now none of these jobs really pay. They don't really work you, and they don't really pay. Everything's gone virtual. Like, you pretend to work, they pretend to pay. You have like this LinkedIn account that you have an identity, like a job, like on your Facebook and your LinkedIn, and your, you have your pronouns on your Twitter, and that's your fucking identity. Like, that's your job, like to exist in social media and to have a title, like a job title in new media is your job. To do new media as a job title in new media. And if you do some stringer shit, or you have some freelance stuff, and you say that you write for the New York Times and your mom's happy gossiping, you know, maybe like in the Jewish community or something like this, running around telling all the her girlfriends after temple on Saturday or some shit like that. You know, I mean, it's just a normal. We're just talking about the culture, expectations, media, the direction it's gone. A lot of these are not paying. And you read it and it's crap. I mean, it's really, really ridiculous crap. So on the subject of ridiculous crap, we have, like, someone wrote an article for a legit, I have to look at this. Someone shared it. It was like for a real newspaper. And it's like, Putin has cut back the Victory Day parade, you know, May 9th, by 30%. And they, you know, even considered canceling it because he's going to roll out this rat-a-tat, you know, depleted army, you know, because they've lost 30% of their army so far, of the whole Russian military has lost 30%. This is like the story. And because, like, and then it's like the thinking is like, okay, so even if that's true, why would you not have a good victory day? Like, do they really parade like 3 million or 2 million? Well, it's really like talking about a million and a 1.2 million like active duty personnel. Is that the victory day parade? So now there's only 700 or 800,000. So you can't do a victory day parade with 800,000. I mean, it just doesn't. You follow what I'm saying? Like, these things don't even fucking make sense. It's like a lie on top of the lie. So then you're like double whacked across the head with two nonsense things. And you're like, well, this thing is not even true in the first place. So then this other part of the story is just like, what drugs are these people on? The idea of running out of missiles, like all these things are like that Russia is running out of missiles. Like, these things are like Doritos. Remember Jay Leno, keep on crunching, we'll make more. This is like Russia with missiles. Like, just, they have factories, you know, they have people whose job it is. They wake up every day and it's like tens of thousands of them, and they go to work to make missiles. Now, there are countries like Ukraine that can no longer make this stuff in sufficient quantities. So when they run out or lose out, that's all there is to it. And the United States has already gone down. It kind of has a very strange approach to military. I won't digress or get into it, but at the end of the day, the United States has neither air, ground, or sea superiority. That's why there's so much focus on the budget. I guess the thinking is that, like, a big number of a budgetary amount somehow makes you think that it's a very powerful military. And it's not. I mean, I had a lot of buddies, and they basically said it's like working at McDonald's. And it's, I mean, of course it is, because so much of the focus of the daily life is on logistics and supply lines. And it's, most of it is McDonald's kind of stuff. It's like boxes of food, like people eat, right? It's like an army, like boxes of food, dried food, freeze dried food. And then a lot of bases, they have like McDonald's and stuff. And then there's people who work at the McDonald's in the army on the base. It's just not meant to fight wars. It's just not, that's just not the doctrine. It's not American military. Fighting wars is not American military doctrine, not at its essence. You really get into the papers and read them, it's about, well, one of the papers written by Mattis. No, not Mattis. Who's the clown now? What's his face? He wrote a paper when he was, I think he went back for officer school or something like this. And he was writing about multipolarity, actually. But he doesn't really seem to understand what multipolarity is. And if you look at his writing style, he'll understand also why he doesn't understand the subject. I mean, you can deliver in a very basic English, you can deliver complex ideas in a very basic English kind of way. In fact, if you can't do that, you probably don't understand the ideas you're talking about. But when you're writing a paper for officer school, and he writes like in weird, like second person, whatever, kind of weird tenses and stuff. It's like, it's not a person who reads or writes very much, because people tend to write the way that they, you know, in the way that they read. So you can tell like what kind of level of people's writing, reading is at, based on kind of like how they write. Anyhow, so he seemed to understand that multipolarity was about sort of like after the collapse of the Soviet Union, but not recognizing that the U.S. was really a unipolar power. And that's kind of interesting, because maybe there's a point to that. Now, I had encountered an idea quite some time ago. It was actually, I think, the U.S. SWP, Socialist Workers Party. Totally insane, waste of time cult, by the way. But I think for $5 or $10 a year, I had a subscription to their paper. It was called The Militant. This is before the internet. Yeah. So if you're not trying to read like something from the New York Times or the LA Times, but you also don't want to read from the fucking John Birch Society. I mean, there was basically the, you know, different communist newspapers, socialist and communist newspapers, And that was the only way to get any real decent information about wars, about the people involved and the names of the factions on the ground. I mean, you really learn a lot of the, you know, who, what, and where from the old communist and socialist newspapers before the rise of the internet. You learn a lot. Now, they have their own reasons about why. And everything is always imperialism and capitalism. And you can take that or leave that if you want. But the who, what, and when, who, what, when, where stuff is fairly accurate. And they have been promoting this idea that actually the U.S. actually lost the Cold War. That was a very strange take. At the time, it didn't make any sense. When you think about what's required to win the Cold War, and when you think now about terms of holographic reality and simulacrum, I mean, the U.S. didn't, like, after the Soviet Union collapsed, was the U.S. like also kind of like on the verge of collapsing? And kind of did it, in a sense, just kind of not covered in the media. Just look at like how people never really recovered from the outsourcing of jobs to China, India, Mexico, Brazil. I mean, those are all fine developing parts of the world. I mean, China's developed, but those are all fine parts of the world. And, you know, those people all have a right to a way of life and everything. But those, the idea of deindustrializing the United States, just mind-blowing. Why would you do that? Because then it's like you have this idea where you conflate situation with time, or you conflate situation or schematic, situational schematic. You conflate that with being somehow the same as progress through time. So this idea that the U.S. is transitioning to away from an industrial economy and towards a service economy, as if that's the future. But it's not like that industry stopped. So then why would you define your society, given that you're still, you know, upstream, downstream? Why would you define your society as post-industrial when your society isn't really a society? It's part of a globalized or globalizing society, which relies then simply on imports from countries where those things that you used to make and that you still need are still being made, albeit elsewhere. And then you import those things and you lose a lot of jobs. Just things to consider. Now, we're going to turn the page and we're going to discuss Israel's situation with Ukraine. And we're not going to go over the hoary details and the whole Kolomoisky and the Netanyahu period and the, this was a different time. This was a different time during the Obama years, and the U.S. was flexing real hard on the Middle East still, and it collapsed. The U.S. has no conventional force capacity to do anything in the Middle East. U.S. military is a not fit for purpose organization. But it was, again, it's not a failure. It's just not, if it's called an army and armies wage wars, it's not fit for purpose, but that's not an accident. It's not like in disrepair and the right people haven't come around. No, it's just not the doctrine. They're actually taking the Marines. I've read this some time ago, and they're making the Marines super, super small. They're super, super downsizing the Marines. They're getting rid of, I think, any air force for the Marines, like any air space-based force that the Marines had is going to be done. And they're getting rid of, a lot of things for the Marines. It's like they're getting rid of the Marines. And then they're going, and then they want to transform the Marines and have a new doctrine of using them for like light operations. I get this, mainly in the Americas. So I wrote like a decade ago that transatlanticism would collapse. The US would not have that much influence in Europe, let alone the Middle East, and would focus primarily on using the power that they have as a regional hegemon and pulling out of the global, I mean, it'd still be a global force, a global media, global interactions, of course, you know, global diplomacy, but militarily, no. So there'll still be a profile. I mean, even the UK has a profile, right? Like international profile. It's a fairly well-known about country within the English-speaking world. But, you know, in the UK, they think it's very important, the things that what they decide to do militarily or something like this. I'm not talking about the city of London, by the way. I'm not even sure that's like in the UK. More like the Vatican or something. How the Vatican is in Italy, but it's not in Italy, right? City of London is something else going on with it. But it's just a location. There's not a military. I mean, the military that does things in the interest of the city of London, somewhere between like the US military and ISIS. I hope this soup does the job. I don't know how I'm gonna eat it. Now, so that's my understanding. With Israel, the U.S. is out of the game of guaranteeing security for Israel. And Russia did a really interesting, like, kind of crazy thing. They entered into Syria on the Syrian side, and they've guaranteed a modicum of security for Syria. They seemed not to react when Israel would target locations within Syria, provided that they were Iranian, despite that Russia and Iran had a tactical co-alliance on Syria. Now, you'll recall that the Russians put in all kinds of these S-400 systems around Tartus and a few other locations. But this didn't... they didn't retaliate, let's say, to Israeli attacks, nor did they
shoot down any Israeli planes as a policy, as a rule. Now, Russia is in Syria, and they have that base, several bases now. They had them to start with. They actually kind of went in to defend the existence of their presence. It's an important port for Russia to have south of Turkey, north of Egypt, right there. It's prime real estate to have a Mediterranean port in the Eastern Mediterranean. There were several situations that almost felt like naval standoffs between the Russian Navy and the French and American Navy. There was a situation with a French boat attacking Syria. Pretty serious stuff. I wrote about it at the time. It was some years ago. Gosh, seems like forever ago. But Tom Luongo at the time concurred with my analysis of those events, and he wrote about it as well. He wrote about it very well. So I've been following these events very closely for a long time. And what I can say now about Israel is that they can't do very much on their own. I mean, they have nukes, but that's like too much of a doomsday scenario. So just talking about conventional, they're in a very bad situation. They've had big fights. There's big fights in Israeli society about the viability and purpose of the settlers, to what extent that exists as some ideological buttress or hindrance, what? You'll remember Ariel Sharon declared that it was an occupation and an unjust occupation and an untenable occupation. Those are his two. He said it was an occupation. He's no dove. He was a former military commander, Ariel Sharon. So Zelensky went to Israel in early March and offended the Israelis by comparing the situation in Ukraine to the Holocaust. And you're just not allowed to do that. It's against the rules. Like, can you imagine whoever his speechwriter was either was ignorant, and that's believable, but also kind of, it's not alarming, it's actually may even create some nice possibilities. But can you imagine that his speechwriter didn't know the rule about writing for an Israeli audience? You can never compare what you're going through to the Holocaust. It's incomparable. You're not allowed to compare anything to the Holocaust at all. It's against the rules in Israel to do that. So they denied his request. Now, there's something they're going to do or have been doing, but the point is that Lavrov said something, okay, about this issue of how can Ukraine be a Nazist state when its leader is Jewish. And Lavrov. See, these statements are super well planned, and it's more interesting to try to figure out what's really going on, because these aren't gaffes. These aren't snafus. These are like really well-placed signals and signs. So to honestly say what he said, okay, and then what's the additional proof? Well, then Maria Zakharova says almost the same thing. She's like a spox. She's like a spokesperson as well. She's like the spokesperson for Russia. She's like spokesperson emeritus, like Medvedev. If we can't rely on Peskov, if we can't rely on Peskov to get the story straight, we've got Lavrov, Medvedev, Zakharova. And together, you get the story. You'll tease out what's really going on. Just like we teased out, like, Ukraine is not going to exist as you knew it. Ukraine's going to get a lot smaller. And any Ukraine that it remains will be a politically neutral state. Will there be a return of Russian forces around Kiev? Well, it's super likely. They did it already. They did it. Get this. Understand this. They two-thirds surrounded Kiev when the Ukrainian military was at 100%. Think about that. Now, the Russian military does not have more than one-fifth of their total active duty personnel in Ukraine. So all of this talk about conscripts, that Putin is going to need to declare war on Ukraine so that he can have the right mechanisms through the Duma to request to implement the conscriptions. It's like, this is a ridiculous, stupid. There's like 200,000 active duty personnel in Ukraine, the Russian. And this is like includes the medics and truck drivers and box loaders and potato peelers, right? This is not just every, it's not Rambo. It's a lot of the logistics and mechanics and drivers, a lot of the, there's a lot of different job descriptions in the military, and you need all of them when you're doing military stuff. So maybe, I don't know if that's a third or a quarter of that. So if they have a 120 or 150, 100 to 150,000 actually soldiers, in the way that we think about it, that would be more reasonable. Okay. But between Russian National Guard and all these other things, they have like 1.2 million, but they have pre-arranged, they can drop another, they can have a total of like 3 million, okay, before they go to some
conscription thing. So short of some kind of like crazy scenario, like, you know, God forbid, the world would be over. Honestly, we would be in a much more like world ending scenario if Russia was in the position where, because of the situation in the world, they needed to do that. They are at a very minimal. They're doing this Ukraine operation with ...20% of their force. And they're up against the largest military of Europe on paper. But there's really a connection, isn't there, between a country's military and what they can actually do and how legitimate their society actually is. You can look at the strength of the military as being a litmus test or a thermometer or like a health check on the whole society. Think about the financialization of the military industrial complex in the United States, and think about how that's just a reflection of the overall culture and practices, a socioeconomic situation in the US. It's actually very much like the military industrial complex. We have like a zaibatsu system of like chosen winners, are totally corporate. Like they just hand these people, we have these actors like Bill Gates or Elon Musk, and they play the role of these, I mean, they're not literally, I'm not calling them crisis actors. This is not for people with paranoid. If you have a schizophrenia issue, like tune out right now, trigger warning. I'm not literally saying they're actors, okay? But they're actors, okay? And you're supposed to have this idea of like the self-made man and all this stuff, but they were actually all intelligence, corporate intelligence projects to kind of put a human face on a brand of a project, of a consortium. Anyway, so, I mean, they have some personality imprint on the thing that they're doing, but everything is monopoly. Everything is, I mean, just look at where these people came from. It's judges, corrupt judges, giving these CIA-backed or Pentagon-backed companies total rights over to have monopoly and non-competitive bidding and to get all the contracts with schools like Microsoft or all the contracts like for this Green New Deal stuff is all Elon Musk. I mean, he's like your Green New Deal boy. This whole thing that he's been able to play with the old people who used to be fans of JPL, Parsons, Jack Parsons, JPL, NASA. He's kind of tried to absorb a lot of that stuff. If you're into like astronaut movies, if you're into those American films about astronauts, like The Right Stuff or anything with Matt Damon or any of these things. And there's supposed to be like this kind of nostalgic Americana stuff happening in the space race and women with beehives and everyone like with horn rim glasses and guys walking around with spats and wingtip shoes and stuff, like waxing their hair. Double-breasted suits. This is like nostalgic Americana. It's a whole thing. It's a market. It's a way of viewing one's own existence in relationship to time, place, and the world. You know that Americans used to think that they were like the center of the world and like Hawaii was like the great frontier. Hawaii and like maybe the Bahamas, the Caribbean was like the untamed world. See, a lot of guys had been in the Navy or in the Army, and they had been stationed in Okinawa and maybe been in the Philippines and stuff. And a lot of sailors, they just think that that's like, they're just the center of the world. You know, build a house in the Philippines or something, become a black belt in karate. And like Americans, like just, they lived in this own world. You know, you in airports and stuff, they're like when they're traveling together in these groups, it's so loud, like they want everyone to hear their conversations and stuff. It's so bizarre. It's really a center of the world mentality, and it blows their mind when they see how well people live in other countries, like because people live better than how Americans live now. They just, Americans are figuring it out like very slowly. So it's totally crazy to me. It's like incoherent, like the left, like the internet left, like the young kids and stuff, like the communists or whatever. And they're like, oh, well, are you Americans and your living standards. Like, kid, aren't you American? What are you talking about, your living standards? Like, everyone in America is like fucking unemployed, like lives in a trailer park. Which is fine if you're happy. As long as you don't have cancer, you know, you're not too late behind on your bills, you don't have cancer, you're doing okay. Okay. Driving a 2005 Ford Focus, Honda Accord, it's all good. You have your kids, you love them, family, it's all what matters. But by living conditions, it's not better than most places, actually. Not for most people. And every country has the super rich. Every country has, you know, Beverly Hills and stuff like that. Every major city has that. Even in the places you would call shitholes, they have rich people, more rich than most rich people that you know, right? So it's like that. Turning the page. This is now asking about Scott Ritter, who has talked about Russia achieving a kill ratio of 15-1 against the Ukrainian forces. What we are not hearing about is the ratio of killed to captured. Okay, I will answer that. Unfortunately, it sounds like the ratio of killed to captured could easily exceed 10-1. This would be an enormous tragedy. You know, Ritter is in a much better position than I am by a long shot to speak in terms of what one would expect with the conditions. 15-1 is within the realm of possibility, but it seems like a very high ratio. Let me think. If there are like 40,000 killed, 2,000 captured, so that would be 20,000 killed to 1,000 captured. So that's like, yeah, 20-1. So that would be that, easily exceed 10-1. Yeah, on the Ukrainian side, it looks like something like that. Many captured, but many more killed. And on the Ukrainian side, they claim that they're not taking prisoners. I mean, that some of that was obviously propaganda from that same stupid set. That stupid set that they shoot everything from. The one that, remember Gonzalo Lira pointed out, like how it's the same set. And we've seen like that cool girl. These people are like dressed in complete tactical. This was like, this is like not realistic. This is not how Ukrainian soldiers are kitted out in the field. They're like wearing beanies and like, you know, those like those North Face looking zipper get-ups, like in brown with a beanie and some camos. It's real, real bad situation. It's a real bad situation if you're Ukrainian in the army and you need kit. And then these guys have like night vision and stuff and like gloves with little fucking compartments on the knuckles. Like, okay, so this is obviously not reality. This is a stage. These uniforms are clean. Just that walkthrough, that same set that they walk through. It's like you're at Universal Studios or something. It's like, okay, everyone just kind of casually walk about. It's sort of like existing. It's sort of like a Fellini film where you just kind of have kind of like realism. Like everyone just walk around, like do the things you would do. It's like, what is this? So there's a lot of artificiality in that. And so I don't know that they're not taking prisoners, but we did have a situation with, you know, last month with, there was an attempt at a prisoner exchange and the Ukrainians ultimately backed out of it. That's very, very disconcerting. We don't know if those Russian soldiers were tortured, killed in captivity, or being ransomed privately, and they're just going, they're just not recognizing the illegitimate Russian regime, and they're trying to deal, who knows, like crazy stuff, the words that come out of people's mouths, how they rationalize things. They could say any fucking crazy thing. Like, we're not going to deal with this. Well, how can we deal with the occupying regime? It's illegal to, they're, what they've done is illegal. It's illegal to be illegal, and therefore they don't exist. Like this kind of backwards thinking. Anyone who listened to that Charlie What's-His-Face guy convincing people about QAnon, I said at the beginning, that guy's a con artist. If something is illegal, then it can't be true. It's like, that's not how things fucking work at all, bro. Like illegal, like bullshit walks all the time. If it's illegal, doesn't mean it's not real. It just means that it's happening until someone prosecutes them, and that ain't gonna happen. So, but he used to play these word games with people. Is it illegal? Yes. And can you do things that are illegal? No. Well, then it's not happening. Oh, okay. I mean, but I can imagine the Ukrainian, I can imagine Zelensky saying, we're not gonna deal with the Russian government because they're illegal. We don't recognize the Kremlin as an authority. We consider them the name that can't be mentioned, occupying force. Now, maybe we're thinking about this too much like Americans, maybe too much when we look at what Russia's doing, we're thinking about it too much like, you know, if you think about it from the point of view of like, if you really believe your country, let's say you were an idiot. I mean that in the classical sense of idiocy, like completely politically unaware, not following the story, not aware that your country lost its sovereignty to the cabal in a series of coups ending in 2014. Yeah. Imagine you didn't know that. Okay. Or you thought that you're going to fight and win the sovereignty in the battlefield from the country that didn't take your sovereignty from you. Whatever your thought process or lack thereof is all about. You've got some kind of narrative. You're Ukrainian, okay? And your country's been invaded by Russians. And I guess if it's your country and you just want them all out and you want to scare them or demoralize them, you might, yeah, I can understand saying shit or feeling shit like we should take no prisoners. I mean, if it's your country and it's like being invaded and it, you know, you weren't provoked per se. Let's say you believe that the Donbas should be part of Ukraine and should not, you know, should not be autonomous in any way. that the language laws and the constitutional changes should have happened, and that's our country, and it's for the better, and that's what you believe. You know, you can see how a lot of people believe that clearly. I mean, we know that they use electronic voting systems, and it's not really clear how many people really voted for Poroshenko. Probably that election was definitely stolen. But with the Zelensky, it was, he lied. That election was not stolen. He just lied about what he believed and what he was going to do. He used to say all the time that the people in the east of the Ukraine should speak Russian if they want to speak Russian, or Crimea. He was on TV saying that. It was like a thing he would say. He's got Russians friends. The Russians and Ukrainians are brotherly people. This is like old Soviet talk he was on about. And it's like, who knows what he believes? Right now, he's trying to channel, I don't know if it's more like Carlito's way or like Scarface, but he's definitely trying to channel this Al Pacino thing. Or maybe that's just how cocaine affects the brain, and it just, it uniformly makes everyone into Al Pacino. I'm not sure which it is, but he is like a method actor, Zelensky. And maybe he's doing Pacino. But he's been doing this. That's like his generalissimo thing. And he speaks in this very weird fake voice. It's almost like a mockery of, it's like a mockery of how Ukrainians conceptualize masculinity. But when Scott Ritter talks about 15-1, oh man, let me think about that one. See, I think that there's been I'll tell you, number one, why the ratio of killed to captured is the way it is, okay? And I explained this a long time ago, and it's been reiterated by people have said the same thing at different times and coming at it from different directions. So no concert there. But what I said quite some time ago is that this is mostly relying on second generation warfare, which is artillery and long periods of time of loosening up an enemy position, you know, how they're dug in, trenches and stuff, being hit with artillery trenches to protect from shrapnel so that only a direct hit, you know, will get you, and being protected by the earth primarily. But enough artillery over time and you're going to hit people, even in the trenches. And those are real nasty. And that's why you're too far away. You're too far away to take prisoners. You get prisoners like with Azovstal. You get prisoners with sieges. You get prisoners like with cauldrons. You get like when you do an encirclement, and then they're just, that's it. You can get a very mass surrender. You've seen that a lot. But right now it's attrition, and they're attriting the Ukrainians in the field, I guess somewhere, you know, it's unclear to me because I don't spend time like with the war maps and because I find those are probably not totally accurate anyway. They're very good guesses based on reports, and then people put physical pins on a map based on reports. But the reports can be chatter, can be like radio chatter that makes its way into like some report that, let's say, a Basudin makes or something, you see? Or just like, sometimes it's disinformation to create wrong maps. So I'd rather not be part of that. It's interesting data, but it's like, it's maybe not even as reliable as these eyewitness testimonies of, or whatever, confessions. All that is politically driven or circumstantially driven. Like we said, if you were captured, like, and they said, hey, you know, relax, call your mom, have a cigarette, have a meal. Now tell us about your evil commander. So some of that's like that with the maps, where they say that they're going, where they say that they're attacking and things like this. Or you get the video of it like days after that. So it's like the things that we think are happening today that might be reported on even today actually happened like 2 days ago, 3 days ago, 4 days ago. And then sometimes you actually caught something when it really happened from a really weird random line of information, maybe through like some obscure Twitter account or something. And you're like, oh, did that happen? And then like 4 or 5 days later, it's like what happened today. And you're like, but that happened 4 days ago. So we've encountered that a lot of times. So I don't even bother with the maps. I mean, the big overview maps, like right now they're gonna claim that a couple of new towns, you know, like in between the sort of triangle between Donetsk, Lugansk, and Kramatorsk, there's like south of Izium, there's going to be some movement on the maps that'll pop up like within a day or two, it'll start showing. And it might not be the biggest movement on the whole map. That, remember, like in the first weeks of the war, the map was changing a lot. So that might not be the biggest, you know, I think that's like 15 or 30 kilometers, but I think they would have moved 15 or 30 kilometers in several different directions in the last couple of days. So that's like maybe 10 or 15 kilometers a day. And then there's the little towns and settlements. But I just want you to know that there's a lot of things that I don't report because I don't think it's interesting. I don't, you know, I try to, like I said, curate the channel a certain way so that it's the most interesting stuff. And, you know, there's like stories I just didn't follow at all because I'm not into, I just don't think it's healthy, and it's just not the way. I mean, I don't judge other people. I'm just saying I don't find it interesting. Like the babushka with the flag and that whole story, I didn't follow it from the beginning because it's just like not, I'm not interested in symbolism. I'm not interested in fucking symbolism. Symbolism is how we got Obama, okay? I'm not interested in symbolic victories or little human interest stories that are emblematic of the whole situation. I just don't, I think that's cheap. Personally, you know, it's not, I think it's tacky. It's not, I don't think other people are tacky or cheap if they find those stories compelling. I just think that stories, not the people who are interested in it, but I think the stories are kind of tacky. It's just real propaganda. All right, let's look here at what we're doing. What do you have? Now, I'm looking at Let me look at this. Okay, here we are. Sorry about that, folks. Oh, yes. So the story, there it is. Yeah. Vladimir Putin humiliated as Ukraine victory parade cut by third over Russian losses.
Yeah, like, why the fuck would the victory day parade be cut by a third?
Unless the whole military, unless like a couple of things, unless Russia had lost one third of its military, wouldn't that be like almost a million people? And then, isn't the thought then that the Victory Day parade has the whole fucking military marching in it? Like, isn't that crazy? Like, and then even if all those things were true, wouldn't it still be like, so what? Because if you're there watching it, like, do you keep track? You're like, you know, it's only 700,000 soldiers this year. It seems really small. Like, what happened? Are they hiding a big loss? It looks like it's 30% smaller. like counting 1, 2, 3. What number are you at, Pop? I'm at 659,217. Oh, okay, 18, 19, 20. Like, get the fuck out of here. Who wrote this? Abigail O'Leary. Like, get a fucking job. For the Mirror? That's the Mirror. So I'm telling you, they don't pay. They can't be paying these people. Like some tofu eating asshole. Abigail O'Leary, where is that? Outside of Dublin. Paying like £6,000 or €6,000 a month to live in a cardboard box. How do these prices, like, who would live? I'm sorry, y'all. I'm not trying to be offensive. I just don't know how y'all do it or why. So, yeah, we talked about Israel. Oh, yes. Very good question here. Mm-hmm. Larry's asking, so turning the page, what happened, he asks, what happened in the Kyiv missile strike that happened when the U.S. Secretary General was in Kyiv? Was that a false flag?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just the timing of that. I mean, I don't know. It's not factually a false flag, but probably is, because there weren't any strikes happening at that time. And Russia, I mean, for other reasons, there weren't any, you know, there wasn't reported on number two, and MOD reports on, you know, Lvov and wherever they strike. Number three, they knew that it wasn't a secret trip or something. So why would they have done that? Like, get out of Ukraine? It's like, that's only going to reinforce like the bullshit story, right? So yeah, I think it's fake. Turning the page. What is the potential of Ukrainian army to launch counteroffensives? Thank you. So we've talked about this, actually. I think actually we talked about this morning, but we got more into the philosophy of leadership. We talked about Hero the Tyrant, Leo Strauss, Socrates. We talked about the psychology of the elite, Kolomoisky versus Julius Caesar. Is it all the same? Is one leader the same as the other? Does it really matter what they believe? Is Kolomoisky the same as Julius Caesar, right? That's how we posed the question fairly well. But we said, let's really look at what's happening here. Let's look at this conflict, and maybe we'll end with this tonight. What's really happening? Is there still reporting? Because I'm tuned out. Is there still reporting that like Russia's losing this? Or, I mean, just again, there's a lot of stories about the humanitarian crisis. There's a lot of stories about
this, but there's no real story about Ukraine's great counteroffensives. At the beginning of the conflict, there was lies being told on the Western, like on American news. They had a guy on a screen. It reminded me of how they report on the elections. So I knew it was bullshit. And it was like in front of a screen. It was like NBC or MSNBC or CNN or whatever. And he's talking about this Ukrainian counteroffensive around Kiev. And that was the last counteroffensive that we heard about. They had a make-believe one in Kherson that was completely make-believe. And it was just a lie. And the people who told the lie knew they were lying. Like, look, I'm a human being. And I have a way of filtering and processing information. And I don't always get it right. But there's two important things here. Number one, I try to get it right. Number two, my mistakes are honest ones. I'm not trying to disinform you or misinform you. But the people who said that there was a active counteroffensive, this is like 50 fucking days ago, in Kherson, were lying and knew that they were lying. I mean, I get it. It's like your team has to win, put your game face on, tell the lie. I mean, I get it. These people don't have the same relationship that I have with you. And you don't have that agreement with them like you have with me. Like, I want to, but for me to do my job with you, I have to tell it how I really see it. And I have to stay on top of the event. And I have to use my mind enough that I can recollect the events and piece them together, connect dots even sometimes. So that's all work that I'm doing for you. And I find great satisfaction in it because I learn a lot. Also, in the process, I keep learning more and more about these things. I remember how I used to report on the conflict in Ukraine, you know, 8 years ago. And I did not think that they were going to have such an imperfect and obviously problematic ceasefire. I just didn't think, I didn't think it was going to be a frozen conflict like the one you have, like where you had in Georgia, where because Russia didn't recognize those Donetsk and Lugansk then, and there were just a lot of weird differences between Georgia, but I didn't think that they would stop the conflict that way after the Debaltseve, but they did. And I developed a different understanding. I mean, I had some clue, but I developed a more nuanced understanding to how Russia does things. And even with that, they're going to do the same way twice. But yeah, Russians like to hurry up and wait. They like to get something done and then kind of like rest on their laurels a little bit, or they like to get something done. And then instead of like using that thing that you've done to like springboard to the next thing, they kind of, Russians kind of seem, from a totally, just from a conversational perspective, they're totally fucking efficient and effective in doing this their own way. Don't get me wrong. But like, if everyone's a critic and we're just going to like Monday morning quarterback this shit or backseat driver or whatever, Russians do have this funny way of getting the thing done and then not multiplying on that thing they got done. Does that make sense? They kind of have a, like, what was it said that was said about a Hannibal Barca? Barca? About Hannibal? That he knew how to make a victory, but didn't know what to do with it. That's kind of like what a person could say if they wanted to just conversationally be critical, like an asshole. If they wanted to say something about Russia, they could say that. Because they do like to get into, they basically move from only an intolerable condition will compel them to force, and then they'll use force not to achieve a victory, but to return to a tolerable condition, not even optimum. They have no vision of optimum. Well, they know what optimum is because that's the thing that's not achievable. This is just like a being silly critical of the Russian mentality. Hurry up and wait. We're not doing it. We're not doing it. We're not doing it. Oh, now we're doing it. What? Okay, go, 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 go. Yeah, Russians do things like that. So I was surprised that, you know, they could have, from a purely military perspective, they could have actually I mean, this is again just total Monday morning quarterbacking, right? Hindsight 2020, and not knowing what they know, and just kind of like, and I think the way things went, if you really understand the situation, if we've gone further, we would understand why not. Okay. But from a purely military perspective, if the Russian military actually got involved, I mean, their presence, what was required of them in Syria was really quite minimal compared to their actual army. What they actually, you know, their commitment in Syria was, it was game changing, and they changed the game with very minimal in terms of their budgetary and their force projection was pretty minimal in Syria, and it was game changing. So then based on that, you look at, they didn't even technically enter into the Ukrainian conflict in 2014. These were like proxy forces that they were supporting. Do you understand? So it's like, if they had gotten overtly in, they would have been able to handle, they could have taken Ukraine, I think probably the whole thing, but it would have changed the game. I mean, there's too many other, you know, you start counterfactual history and too many factors you have to account for. But economically, they weren't in the position to sustain the sanctions that would have come. And there's also the relational aspect and the political or power dynamic of these different oligarchs and where they are with things and where they kind of need to be with things and where they will get placed in the scheme of things when the proverbial excrement hits the propeller. Now I'm going to just look at your, quickly look at your okay, yes. Being asked, any thoughts on Lula in Brazil and him taking and him talking about following up with Chavez's plans for South American currency. I think that this is the direction that things will go, but I don't think that Bolsonaro is against that either. Bolsonaro is not against this. He's just a different. He appeals to a different part of the country, but there are some pretty firm things that have happened in Brazil, and there's been a shift in the deep state in Brazil is on board with the direction that Lula and then Dilma were going, just in terms of BRICS. And just because you get a kind of pseudo populist, but more kind of like conservative middle class kind of candidate like Bolsonaro run the country, there wasn't a real change in Brazil's orientation to the world. There was now keep this part in mind. There was a pretty decent relationship between Bolsonaro and Trump, which would tend in other time frames would make you think that this is a typical, right-wing Latin American government that's close to Washington. But that wasn't what Trump was, and that's not what that relationship was all about. It's just during the Trump administration was almost like a BRICS administration in America. It was almost like something like that. I know it's hard to think of it in those terms, but the issues with China were good for China. The issues that Trump had with China were good for China and good for the U.S. had that gone in that way. But it's just a misread of the situation, how people on the left tend to understand Bolsonaro. But I would say that the idea of a Sucre, Mercosur, the Mercosur development, and like a digital currency, like where they have like the Sucre or different versions of this, this is very fine. This is basically, if you look at in Chile with Allende, they basically did an internal system of a, they had a digital currency purely for, supply and demand and markers. And they basically used, primitive, like fax machine type stuff, giving like telegraph type signals, between different companies in productive process from the raw materials. I think this was like tin in Chile. It was really brilliant what Allende was doing with that. Anyway, what you need for a Latin American, like before you have a single currency in Latin America, which is a good thing, ultimately, probably a good thing, but before you have a single currency in Latin America, you need to have a layer behind it, which is just a universal accounting system of the supply of materials, so that you reduced some of these marginal costs and can increase the efficiency, so that you've increased the signals between the different locations of production and things like this. That would go in the direction ultimately of like a single currency. And now, the problem with Chavez's plan is that it was too much connected to the European Union, and it was effectively like a continuation of some type of Atlanticism, but the Eastern branch of Atlanticism. And the Eastern branch of Atlanticism have more co-integration with China. So in terms of allowing the Chinese, it doesn't mean the Chinese are open to them, but them allowing Chinese to come in and do part of it. So China had a big, had a role, still has a role in Venezuela, and in that, and separate from, you know, that government, but just economic development in Latin America in general. But a lot of the banking stuff is still, it's the European side of the transatlantic banking. It's all basically the trilateralism. We talked about this in a prior episode, and like Latin American leftism in Latin America post Soviet collapse, like from the middle 90s onwards, is like a completely different thing. It's a completely different thing. It's not, there are communist parties, but there's no Soviet Union. And the Chinese are not a evangelical communist sect. It was completely a European banking. There was a lot of things. I know this sounds funny because it's called like Bolivarianism and Simon Bolivar and national liberation, fight against Spain and stuff like this, but actually a lot of these German and French banks working through Spanish subsidiaries were involved in the Venezuelan story and the Bolivarianism and the whole pink tide phenomenon. And kind of one of the realizations and kind of the linchpin, or I don't know, maybe a wake up call or whatever you want, you know, however this, the keystone was Argentina. How you got Kirchner. And the other thing was, then you got in Brazil, after Lula goes down, and then Dilma comes in, and then Dilma goes down, and you get this total swing in this other direction, this whole other force of power. You get Bolsonaro, and you're thinking, oh God, you know, what's this? But you can see fully committed to the BRICS and did a lot to resist the COVID story too. There's a lot going on, very interesting. Yeah, I didn't like the guy at first, but now he makes sense to me. I don't know that I would like him personally, or that, you know, I would like the way he smells, or that he would, you know, that I don't exist. And, you know, I know his name, he doesn't know mine, you know what I'm saying? But here I am, just a fly on the chariot wheel of history, shouting charge. But, you know, I started to like the guy. In terms of, you read newspaper articles and stuff, and people are attacking him, and you're like, who's attacking him? You know, you're like, why do they say this shit all the time about Bolsonaro? So yeah. Chavez's proposal of a Latin American currency is a smart one. And in conclusion, it's simply for it to succeed and to become more of a sovereign currency shared between a growing Latin American, you know, pole in this multipolar world. You're going to need to have a Latin American pole. Brazil is a leader in that pole. It's a little bit odd just because it's Portuguese, but linguistically, it's not Latino America in the way that people think of it. It's Brazil. It's like its own thing. And the Brazilian thing is different in many ways, but it is part of it. Gran America, or there's different iterations that you would include Brazil as, you know, Latin America. In terms of all the politics, it's very Latin American. Just as a hub of, you know, of that whole pole. It's not obvious, but economically, it's huge powerhouse. Mexico is huge too. I think between I think some type of tacit agreement or alliance between Mexico and Brazil would resolve the would guarantee like a lot of good development in Latin America for the coming like 20-30 years. Those are my thoughts on that. Thank you for the question. I'm going to turn the page now. So, yeah, just wrapping up then, I want to thank everyone for being here. I'm just going to end on confirming that, yeah, Lukashenko, just so everyone remembers, president of Belarus revealed that he was cajoled by the World Economic Forum and the IMF, and the IMF tried to offer him $1 billion. It was like 900 something million dollars. So let's just call it $1 billion, right? Okay. To do the whole story there. To do the whole like, everyone has to wear a mask and lock down. Oh my God. And he didn't do it. And this showed, though, this was a very important story for the world with tremendous liberatory outcome potential and an already experienced outcome, because many people started to learn and see that the simulation of this COVID thing going around the world wasn't that a lot of these countries' leaders really thought there was a threat, or that they were part of the, or that they had been part of like Klaus Schwab Young Leaders Forum or whatever. That was a nonsense story anyway. It doesn't mean anything. It has no bearing on decision making on any level. Klaus Schwab talks his own book. What a surprise. It's like when a person starting a company wants to attract investors and they talk up the potential of this company or this product, or they talk it up. They don't talk it down. They talk their own book, right? They don't talk someone else's book. So they just, that's Klaus Schwab. Just many bullshit stories from Schwab, but you could see that it was the IMF. That's why I say, like, you know, World Economic Forum is just like the think tank of the IMF. And IMF is in a very weird position because of its unique relationship between central banking and private banking. And it's composed of private banks, but keep in mind that in the U.S., these are kind of commingled with the Federal Reserve in terms of the owners, right, and the policies and the politics. So, and that's what transatlanticism is so much based in, is this New York-London axis. And then between New York-London, or you could say Washington, New York, London, whatever, you know, how do you manage and kind of perpetually derail and confuse this European Union story? You know, how do you keep Germany from getting strong, but also strong enough to be able to say no to Russia, but not so strong that they can say no to you? It's a tough one. It's like NATO. Well, why is NATO there? Right? To keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. Yeah. So they're very well aware that this is an occupation in Europe. They're very well aware that Europeans are well aware that American bases are not daycare centers. Yeah. That's what an occupation looks like. So it doesn't look like anything else. There's not some other thing that's missing from this equation. The U.S. is militarily occupying many countries of Europe. Okay, and just because the same cabal's banking sector can use banks to create tremendous political pressure on these European governments so that those governments say things like, thanks for coming, America. We love hosting your base here, like sock puppet. Okay. I don't mean to be cynical. I'm skeptical of the cynicism of others. Very good. I want to just thank all of you. This was like a later night. We just wanted to get to the questions and prompts that we had from this morning. We talked about other things instead. I'm going to get this up on the drive now. And you guys have a great rest of the evening. I know I will. Take care.